Well, regardless of what some people might tell you, Americans are incredibly generous people. And the charitable contributions of some very special Americans have led to amazing advances in science, in medicine, and in the arts. And joining us to tell us about some of those wonderful stories is Carl Zinnmeister. He's vice president for publications at the Philanthropy Roundtable. For almost 13 years, Carl was the editor-in-chief of the American Enterprise. And from 2006 to 2009, he served as chief domestic policy advisor to the president and director of the White House Domestic Policy Council. Good morning, Carl, and welcome to Faith Radio.
Hi, Bill. It's great to be with you.
To start off with, give us an idea of the size of the nonprofit sector in our country.
Well, you know, it's much bigger than people realize, Bill, and more important than people realize. Part of the reason that we don't understand that is because it's often done privately and anonymously and on a local level. You know, philanthropy is very decentralized. It's not a big, you know, program that you can kind of point to. And so we tend to underestimate it. But the reality is that philanthropy today is, for instance, about half again as big as our national defense sector. You know, often people talk about the so-called military-industrial complex as an example of a big, you know, important industry. And actually, the nonprofit world, as I say, is much bigger, has been bigger than national defense since 1993 and continues to grow. And that's just if you consider it on a kind of cash basis, the amount of money that changes hands, which is $360 billion a year. That's how much Americans voluntarily donate.
Wow.
To good causes. And in addition to that, Bill, there's the volunteer labor that people give, which is about that same amount more. It depends, you know, on exactly how you value that labor. But if you put a, you know, a reasonable estimate of what people's time is worth, then the volunteer hours is another $300 or $400 billion. So it becomes a very big chunk of our economy and of our culture.
You know, I worked for an organization that had a significant number of volunteers, and they would have a volunteer award ceremony every year, and they would talk about how many hours somebody had put in or how many years they had volunteered for the organization. And I can't remember the exact number of employee hours and just the employee workload that many of those volunteers kind of, you know, they took off the plate so that the organization didn't need to spend the time and the resources, because they had these wonderful, skilled volunteers. Many of these individuals, by the way, were retired people who had, you know, they'd worked for years in a particular industry. So they had these great skills. And rather than, you know, just going off taking an extended fishing vacation, they were, you know, applying those skills to this organization and serving. It was a ministry organization, and they were serving on a daily basis. And I just felt every time I'd see one of these folks in the hall, I would just stop and say, thank you. Thank you for what you do. And they, you know, a big smile would light up on their face. And we really need to hold up and put a spotlight on our volunteers in this country, don't we?
Oh, Bill, you're so right. That's a wonderful example. And, you know, when you are one of those volunteers, perhaps it's easy to think, well, you know, how much difference am I making? I'm doing my 3 hours a week in this one little place, but it's such a big country. How can I help? You have to remind yourself that if everyone does the same thing, you know, you work in your backyard and I work in my backyard and the guy across the street is doing his thing and the guy in the next county over is doing his thing, that aggregates together into the, you know, a mighty river of effort, and it really does change the world. And you're right, our volunteers are tremendously important. That, you know, it isn't just a matter of being helping hands or being there when needed. That's obviously important, the simple grunt labor and effort involved. But in addition, what often happens with charity that rarely happens in government helping programs is that you have a human connection. You have a relationship that builds up. You have a friendship. You have some trust. You have some mentoring. You have some human kindness. You have some moral lessons transferred that makes a difference in the recipient's life. And as I say, it's very hard, almost impossible to do that in government programs. It's unconstitutional half the time. But in private philanthropy, it's very common, and it's often what really changes a heart or a behavior pattern that has been destructive. So it really is a bigger than it even seems at first glance.
There is something so key about developing those personal relationships with people in need. And as you said, mentoring and coming alongside them, encouraging them, makes a huge difference, doesn't it?
It sure does. You know, Mother Teresa used to say, I never think about groups. I think about individuals. And, you know, that's really true about most good philanthropy. And it's not just a matter of preference. It's you have a different prescription. You have a different approach when you look hard at a real person as opposed to saying, well, oh, that's a recently released prisoner and he needs X, Y, and Z, or that's a welfare mom and she needs A, B, and C. Instead of that kind of, you know, grand, broad brush thinking, you approach person as an individual and you look at what their strengths are and what their weaknesses are. You tend to have a different set of prescriptions. And that is what makes real grassroots case-by-case philanthropy so much more effective in many cases than, the more anonymous help of just writing a check. Mm-hmm. And you can get into all kinds of examples, the Salvation Army, Goodwill, Habitat for Humanity. Those kinds of charities are extraordinarily effective. Most of those are at the top of their class in terms of helping people with substance abuse problems, helping people with job skill problems, helping people with disabilities. Why are they at the top of their class? Basically because, as I say, they approach people as individuals. They look closely at their character, at their specific needs. They don't give them the things that would be destructive for them. They do give them the things that they really need. And it is a real, you know, problem-solving method.
Carl, about a month ago, you gave a speech at Hillsdale College. They're a Center for Constitutional Studies and Citizenship in Washington, D.C. In fact, your talk was transcribed for the Imprimis Monthly Digest, which I receive at home. And I actually read your remarks one Saturday morning while I was having breakfast, and I found myself inspired and challenged by some of the stories you told. And you made a very strong case for private philanthropy in that talk, and you cited a lot of historical examples, many of which I'd never heard of. And I'm wondering, for a few minutes, could you take us on a bit of a historical tour of philanthropic work in the United States?
Sure. There's just so many wonderful things, Bill. And as you point out, it's really not been properly reported. Many of these stories were unfamiliar to me, too, until I got into the research. And I just asked myself why. I kind of felt like an archaeologist who was, digging up these dinosaur bones that hadn't been looked at in years and years and saying, these are tremendous stories that ought to be more broadly understood. Some of it is, the individual stories are representative, I think, of lots and lots of people standing behind them. And kind of touching on what we just started with, it's often not the money that these people are giving away. The money is important, obviously, but in many cases, it's the leadership they provide, the fresh ideas they bring, the energy and the new solutions. Let me give you a quick example from an area that almost no one thinks that philanthropy has anything to do with, and that would be national defense. If you could think of an area of our life where it's more clearly, the government's responsibility and there's not much that, an everyday citizen can do, you would think, well, that's national defense. I was just shocked, Bill, when I got into this and realized, actually, even in national defense, there are all kinds of examples of private philanthropy being important. And one of the ones I'll quickly describe to you was a guy named Alfred Loomis, who, to make a long story short, became one of the wealthiest Americans in the country around the time of the Depression. He just made some very smart bets. And he always had loved science. So as soon as he made this fortune, he quit and he put all of his energy and time and most of his money into building up a really impressive scientific lab. Literally in a home across the street from his own. And I mean, this was first rate. It was better than most of the university labs anywhere in the world. And he went to work on some hard problems. He was not just a dabbler. He really did some very, very significant science. And then World War II came along and Alfred Loomis happened to visit Berlin. And when he got there, he was just terribly impressed by two things. One is how popular Hitler was with the German people. That scared him. And second, he was impressed with how powerful and effective German scientists were. And he came home convinced that war was brewing and that science was going to have a lot to do with who won that war. So he went to work. Again, he didn't ask permission. He didn't try to get a government grant. He didn't encourage some bureau to do it. He did it himself. He quickly zeroed in on a technology he thought might be very important in the coming war, which was using radio waves to detect moving objects. Which is, of course, not what we now call radar. Didn't exist until that point. And Alfred Loomis threw himself into this, poured a lot of his own money into it, recruited brilliant minds to work with him, and very quickly became the national expert on radar. And not only figured out the theory of it, but then actually started producing sets. And again, to make a long story short, he ended up overseeing the production of most of the radars that went into airplanes and ships and really turned the tide of the war. And Winston Churchill later said that there was no civilian other than Winston Churchill who had more to do with winning World War II than Alfred Loomis. Yet, as you point out, though, I doubt any of our listeners have heard his name and realize how significant he was, and that especially realize that this was basically a privately driven effort. At that point, the government defense labs were basically saying that things like radar or the atomic bomb, of course, those are important and interesting, but that's for the next war. You know, that's to worry about down the road. And Loomis said, that's insane. He said, these are things we have to master now. Our enemies are hard at work on them. And he jumped in there with all 4 feet and produced solutions. And as I point out, it was partly his money that made the difference. I mean, he helped produce the cyclotron, for instance, that purified the atomic material that was used in the bombs that won the war in Japan. So he actually got involved in that specific way. But it wasn't just his money; it was his drive, it was his energy, it was his different perspectives, and that's true of a lot of philanthropy.
Most of us have had a Hershey's chocolate bar at some time, but we might not know the background of Milton Hershey and what he has done for orphans in this country. Carl, tell us that story.
Yeah, well, it started in sadness, as some philanthropy does. Milton Hershey himself had a pretty sad childhood. His father was an alcoholic and not present very much. There was a lot of need and poverty during his childhood. And when he grew up and became a successful man, he was determined that other American children should be spared from that same kind of life. So he and his wife started very small, like philanthropy often does, and they initially just built a cottage, a little home right near their home, and they installed in there a married couple who would be in charge of overseeing a group of orphans that needed help and supervision and upbringing. And one cottage became two, and two became four, and four became eight, and soon there was just a ring of these homes that they built in a circle around their own family home, and started providing not only warm, loving homes for these children, but also very, very good education and vocational training in addition. And Hershey himself was very personally involved. I mean, he would every night after work walk through the cottages and greet the children. He knew them well and had a relationship with them in addition to being their patron. And this orphanage became very, very successful. When Hershey died, he and his wife left basically their entire company to the orphanage, to what's called the Hershey School. And it continues to be basically the owner of the chocolate company and has, as a result, an enormous endowment that allows it to provide free education and upbringing today. Today, it's not just orphans, which, of course, thank God, have become less common with the control of various diseases, but it's children who have come from families that are not able to take proper care of them or other sort of sources of distress. And literally thousands of these children have gone through the Hershey School and gone on to successful lives as a result of these gifts.
That's beautiful. I've actually been to the Hershey Amusement Park there in Pennsylvania and sampled some of that chocolate. I had no idea that the Hershey School actually owns the chocolate factory now and continues obviously making a profit, but putting that money to very good use to this day. So that's beautiful. Carl, you've also shared the stories of several just ordinary folk in your speech that you gave at Hillsdale, and mention a few of these individuals. These aren't people that had a lot of money, but they're people who made a significant difference with what they did have.
And they're not just exceptions either, Bill. One of the points I make in the book that this is all drawn from, the new book we just put out is called The Almanac of American Philanthropy. And one of the points I'm really anxious to have people understand is that while these stories of, let's call them moguls, big successful business people, while these are very interesting and important, they are not really the main body of philanthropy in the U.S. The figures will surprise people. Only 14% of all the charitable money given in a year, it comes from places like the Gates Foundation, the big foundations that about. Only 5% more comes from corporations. So where does the other 81% come from? Well, it comes from individuals. And most of that, by the way, comes from normal middle-class everyday people who give in this country at the rate of about $2,000 or $3,000 a year. That's the average. And you multiply that by hundreds of millions of households and you get big money. So that's really the iceberg. The tip of the iceberg is, as I say, the Gateses of the world and the Hersheys of the world that we often see because their giving is so prominent and so big in one place. But there's really a much bigger mass underneath the iceberg, which is what average everyday people do. So with that in mind, in the Almanac of American Philanthropy, I try to do a lot of storytelling about what those everyday people look like and how they've had their effect. And there's just some all kinds of beautiful stories. Many of our listeners will know someone in their own life or a neighbor, perhaps themselves, who epitomize this. And it doesn't have to be heroic. Sometimes it is heroic. For instance, I tell about the story of a guy who shines shoes in the Pittsburgh area. Just a very simple person. And about 25 years ago, he decided he was going to give all of his tips as a shoe shine man to the Children's Hospital Fund, where families who need medical care for children under extreme circumstances and can't pay for it get reimbursements. And over the course of the next quarter century, he gave a couple of hundred thousand dollars, which was a big portion of his income, to this children's fund. There are lots and lots of examples like that, and it's really it's where the real horsepower comes from in our country. Is this individual local giving? And as I say, it's easy to sort of feel like, well, I'm just a drop in the bucket. But if you add it together, it becomes really an enormous and powerful force.